Welcome to the RSP Cast. I'm Matt Waldman with the Rookie Scouting Portfolio. This is episode number 56, and we're going to talk about the 2019 quarterback class. I just finished the quarterback chapter for the 2019 Rookie Scouting Portfolio publication. Took me about a week to do. It's roughly 90 pages in length on 20 quarterbacks. That's kind of the depth that you see with the Rookie Scouting Portfolio every year. If you're new to that publication, haven't heard much about it, you've just been on this podcast and enjoying that, first of all, thank you for enjoying this podcast and making it a regular part of your listening rotation. The RSP publication, you can find out more about it at mattwaldman.com and take the video tours. Just to tell you, if you are new to it, it is by far the best thing that I do in this space. Okay. So we're going to talk a little bit about the publication, some of the things that are new to it, and my thoughts on some of these quarterbacks, at least in a way where I'm not giving away the farm in terms of my rankings or anything like that, but just things that I think stood out about some of these players and what I thought about them. But first, you know, before we do that, I want to talk about the kind of an overview of this class, because in my opinion, this class will go a long way towards answering a question. And that question is the NFL entering a new era with its approach to young quarterbacks? Or has the past 2 to 3 years with these quarterback classes been somewhat of an anomaly when it comes to the success of this, of the quarterbacks? And I think the way that you have to answer this question to begin with is that the origin of it is traced back to the 2016 class. Because that's the time that I remember when mainstream media started giving weak marks to that class before the NFL Combine. And even up to that point, it was like, this isn't that very good of a class. There's nobody here who's on par with Jameis Winston or Marcus Mariota. Both those guys came off a really strong starts to the year, and they looked like they were poised for excellent work down the line. Maybe they might become the future franchise quarterbacks, you know, the young guns in the NFL at that time after the 2016 season. And, you know, we saw what happened. You know, Jameis Winston and Marcus Mariota. Now, if you look at Jared Goff, Carson Wentz, and Dak Prescott and compare them to Winston and Mariota, you wouldn't say that they're weaker. You might say they're stronger. It depends on your point of view, but it's not an absolute joke to put all five of these guys in a similar tier of play. You know, each have strengths, each have things that they need to work on. So one of the things that happens, though, when you talk about the buzz that these players get before the draft, like after the combine, is that the skeptics, they're going to see this as a dynamic that's kind of an annual phenomenon of draft season analysis. Regardless of the reputation that the current quarterback class earns before the combine, these critics claim that the national media always gives the top 2 to 3 or 3 to 4 players in this class a healthy pre-draft PR boost. And, you know, there's a bit of a conspiracy theory to this, if you ask me, but there's a grain of truth embedded within any of these conspiracy theories, because there's no doubt that national media is looking for compelling stories to earn its audience. And if you look at listening data or content consumption, I would bet that quarterback-driven narratives generate a ton of interest, because the NFL is a quarterback-driven league. Look at the way they made the rules to protect the quarterback the way they do. They don't do that because, you know, quarterback isn't important not only to a team, but also to, you know, viewers. So on top of that, too, it's hard for NFL teams to find quarterbacks. We've been through that a lot in terms of after the first round, it drops significantly in terms of the hit rate. They have a difficult time developing quarterbacks, which is an argument I've made repeatedly, that they really have a tough time doing that because of the structure of their finances, the structure of how they retain coaches and GMs. So there's lots of turnover. The contracts aren't long. Free agency is a big deal, and you have impatient ownership driving a lot of it. So the thing is that getting quarterbacks, especially in the draft, it's a lot like this time of year, players do get bumped up because of their physical potential or their technical potential or something that appeals, that's appealing about them that may suggest they could be franchise players. And as a result, you kind of get a little bit of desperation, as Bill Parcells and Bill Polian have both stated years ago when they've been on shows talking about the dynamic that's involved in front offices when it comes to this time of year and the need for a quarterback. So if you think that the guy could be a franchise guy, then you got to go with him in the first round, or else you might not get a chance at him. And the chances that you land another quarterback later statistically have been slim, historically have been slim. So it kind of feels like desperation at happy hour when closing time comes and you haven't taken anybody home. I've written about this in that way exactly, to with that exact analogy in regards to Terrell Pryor years ago. So we know, as you know, media members or analysts, that touting quarterbacks as potential first round picks or focal points of the draft is going to generate interest. Even if there isn't a consensus number one, the idea that you can play them off each other of who will go number one, who will sneak into the first round, is going to generate a wide variety of passionate responses, ranging from people who know a little bit more about the game than others, who are like really up, you know, really just kind of sick of hearing that kind of ploy and feel like it's a ploy, to some people who are just passionate fans and are hoping that one of these players who's touted lands on their team over another, you know. So there's a wide variety of responses to it. But the thing is that when you look at this 2016 class, we saw that while they've had their ups and downs, Goff took his team to a Super Bowl. Wentz got his team in position, and then Nick Foles was able to help bring it home. But Wentz certainly had a strong second season before his injury. And then Dak Prescott, I mean, he had a historic rookie year. And while his second year was okay and his third year it was definitely down, then started to rebound upward, these are guys that you can look at and say, this wasn't such a bad class after all. And I think that, you know, some people will look at that and say, well, they're system passers. Goff's basically a puppet for McVay. Well, okay. Maybe there's reason to look at it that way, but it's reasonable to wonder, whether, you know, the 2016 class is skilled or a product of surrounding talent and effective schemes. I think both points can be true, to quote my buddy Matt Harmon. I think coaches deserve credit for expanding the NFL offensive canon in order to capitalize on the talents of its quarterbacks. And the quarterbacks in these systems, they deserve credit for executing the system and even creating when the system breaks down, which is often the case in pro football. There are really no puppets. There really aren't. I mean, Goff had a bad Super Bowl, but if you really break it down, and Eric Stoner did a great job in my interview with him post-Super Bowl at mattwaldmanrsp.com, you can read about that and see how Sean McVay certainly is culpable for a lot of the struggles that Goff had. And it's not because that, you know, he didn't tell Goff to do the right things. It's because of the system that McVay created and his unwillingness in that entering that game to make adjustments and game plan in a way that could actually foil the grand master, Bill Belichick. Now, moving on from the 2016 class, the 2017 class also is very system oriented when you think about it. Now, and when they were coming, you know, out in the draft, there were a lot of people who looked at them and said, oh, forget about this Deshaun Watson or Mitchell Trubisky. He's just meh. Patrick Mahomes, he's just kind of a wild child in a spread offense. What's he really going to do? Wait till you see this 2018 class with Josh Allen and Josh Rosen and Sam Darnold. Those guys, you know, those guys are really going to be a set of generational talents. Forget about this 2017 class. But when you think about what's happened, I mean, Patrick Mahomes is the generational talent. Deshaun Watson is capable of Pro Bowl weeks in terms of the way that he's played. And Mitchell Trubisky certainly started to come on in the system that was there with Matt Nagy. And all three of those guys have a lot of collegiate influences in the systems that they played in, influences with the especially with Watson and Mahomes, influences of systems that they played in college applied to their NFL teams. But I don't think anyone would accuse them of being purely system quarterbacks and puppets for their coaches. Trubisky, you know, certainly as well, the fact that they could spread the field and then use him more as a runner and capitalize on his legs has really also helped out that offense. And his statistics actually, you know, really grew from his rookie year, which were, you know, he was in a more conservative offense. So when you think about it from that standpoint, those guys certainly performed well. And while you can credit their talent, you also have to credit the scheme in terms of being able to make the most of their talents. And at the same time, when you look at the 2018 class, Darnold, Rosen, and Allen, these guys, if you really think about it, they weren't regarded as system quarterbacks, but ironically, the only one of those three who had sustained success was arguably Allen. And that only happened after the Bills said, you know what, forget it. You know, your ability to read the field is a work in progress at best right now. Go ahead and run the ball if you don't see anything come open. You know, we're not going to sit here and try and harp on how you read certain things. We're just going to let you run the ball. And you're not doing it as much from, you know, any type of spread look or, you know, zone read work. We're just going to let you drop back from center, do some rollouts, do some draws, do some keepers, or just scramble. We're fine with that this year. I mean, that's vastly different than the system quarterbacks like Lamar Jackson and Baker Mayfield, who were considered system quarterbacks in many camps. And those guys actually had more success, I would argue, than any of the other three that were mentioned, and they were the most successful of the five as a whole. So you think about those two teams, the Browns and Ravens, they worked to match their systems to their quarterbacks, and they earned playoff caliber work from their rookies. And that's from a guy who that some people think Jackson may not be a long-term starter. I think he is. I think he was the second most talented quarterback in this class, despite the fact that he may have had some fundamental flaws that are concerning to traditionalists. But then you had Mayfield, who a lot of people thought was the number one overall guy, and he turned out to be. But at the same time, he only played to the level that he was capable of for an extended period of time after Freddie Kitchens took over, and the dysfunction in Cleveland's offense between Todd Haley and Hugh Jackson was basically thrown out the door. And at that point, if you look at the stats before week 9 and then after week 9, you'll see that there's a big difference there. So I think the big takeaway for this is that from 2016 to 2018, those rookie classes have proven that the spread offense and different option plays and different ways of looking at things that are either add-ons to the West Coast offense or have air raid type of influences, that these can be effective in the NFL. And it shows that teams didn't need a vast library of plays every week. They could focus on a core set of plays and force opponents into read and react type of binds, and then they could adjust based on the volume of plays they run to see how the defense is playing it, and then adjust and run counters to that without having a huge library that they have to force their quarterbacks to learn. And I think that these streamlined offenses capitalize on the strengths of its young passers in ways that it leads to players playing rather than overthinking. And that overthinking can really slow their learning curves, and it can force them to make mistakes that you didn't even see on their college tape because they're overthinking. And these offenses like the Eagles and the Colts and the Chiefs and the Bears, Browns, even the Ravens, they have a lot in common with systems we've seen at the college game. Some of them have a lot in common with Oklahoma, Ohio State, West Virginia, Missouri, Washington State. These are the recent homes of 2019's class. So, you know, this 2019 class didn't earn a lot of buzz this year. It was like, wait for that Trevor Lawrence kid at Clemson. You know, wait for Jake Fromm, which, you know, I think a lot of people are like, maybe not. But you see what I'm saying. It's always that phenomenon. And that phenomenon really comes from the fact that because basically after the draft, after the Todd McShays, the Mel Kuypers, the Mike Mayocks, or at least in the past, the John Grudens, at least in the past, whoever it was who was running, Riddick and Daniel Jeremiah, I know that these guys work hard. They're watching over 700 prospects every year. But if you're watching over 700 prospects every year, you're probably not watching. The majority of them are not guys that you're going to be looking at the following year. So when editors and publishers ask these guys to comment on what's the strength of next year's class, they don't know. They have a basic idea, maybe from casual watching while they were studying somebody else, but they don't have the complete set of data. They have an educated guess about it. And they even state that. So I'm not indicting these guys. They're just beginning. Now they've got to present it like they've been watching these guys for years and really studying them hard. And maybe some of them they have, because they expected them to come out, in 2018, and then it turns out they're going to come out in 2019 or something along those lines. But the thing is that they have to present this information because they're being asked to. And then because they're seen as the national authorities in the media, then, regional media and local media uses that information. And then the content heads for those groups say, listen, Daniel Jeremiah said that this player is one of the top quarterbacks in the class. Todd McShay said this, this running back is a guaranteed first round pick. Whatever it is that they said back in May, that kind of gets the ball rolling, and you see layers and layers of more information where these players get hyped up because the top people said it in terms of the most national exposure, and it kind of trickles down to the regional and local media scene to the point that these takes get reinforced, and they get reinforced even with discussion where people disagree. That gets reinforced that these names belong on the boards when there hasn't been enough study yet to really confirm that. Okay. So maybe there'll be times where certain scouts who've been watching these guys a little longer and studying them might be able to give some credence, but there's a reason why Logan Thomas was Todd McShay's first round pick for, Mel Kuyper years ago. And then by year's end, he wasn't even going to be, a high draft pick at best, or Lee Suggs, a running back out of Virginia Tech, who a lot of people thought might be a first round pick, or Madre Hill. And next thing these guys are undrafted free agents. No, it happens every year that way. So the whole buzz thing, some of that's a media generated thing. The wrong players get the buzz because it's just too early to really talk about them. But we know that the development practices are very important, and that means that you have to have intelligent matching of scheme to player. And at that point, basically this 2019 class, if you ask me, is going to help us understand a little bit more if the NFL has looked at 2016 to 2018 and realized, hey, we can get a lot more out of these young quarterbacks if we play to their strengths and fit the system around them rather than force them to learn, I don't want to say archaic systems, but traditional systems that take a lot more time to really acclimate and get onboarded to, as to use a really crappy corporate term. But, that's the thing about this class that's going to be interesting, because you've got guys like Locke and Murray and Will Greer and Haskins, and even the Duke kid Daniel Jones, and you wonder can we borrow enough from their college concepts to create an offense that can get them up to speed fast and allow them to just play rather than overthink things. And The answer so far, if you ask me, from 2016 to 2018, the answer is yes. The next question is, will the NFL embrace that? And we're about to find out. So I think that's what makes this class really interesting. Now let's kind of move on here and talk about this RSP publication and what I've looked at here, because I've done some new work this year. I decided to expand my charting process for quarterbacks. And so I started looking at 7 to 10 games for as many prospects as I could. And I looked at different categories. You know, the categories are, there's broad ones like throwing on platform, which is, you know, a traditional drop, set, and throw. It can even be on platform, you know, a mobile throw. A throw on a rollout can even be on platform, because you can see the difference between a platform style traditional technique and a less traditional or unconventional technique that I would call off platform. So you have on platform, you have off platform, you have mobile on platform, mobile off platform, you have opposite hash throws that are opposite field throws, you know, throwing from one side of the field across the middle to the opposite flat or opposite sideline, and doing that whether you're doing it on platform or off platform. I have on script, you know, scripted plays and unscripted plays with all of those things that I just mentioned. I also have all of those plays, you know, against zone or against man, all those plays against pressure or without pressure, and different combinations with, you know, the zone, man, scripted, unscripted, platform, off platform. So I have a ton of different, you know, things that I'm looking at. And I whittled it down to really what I would also do is then look at the ranges of the field. So, you know, I looked at these platform, off platform types of categories into, you know, and divided up the field into like the short middle, the short flat, the short sideline, then also the middle flat and sideline for intermediate throws and vertical throws and deep throws. And I've talked in the past about why I separate these into four categories as opposed to just three. But they're in 14-yard increments. And I looked at how accurate these players were. And when I judge accuracy, what I found doing this charting is, as I tested it out this summer a little bit more, is that, you know, a lot of people look at it and say, is it catchable? If it's catchable, then it's accurate. And I think that that's a good starting point for accuracy, because, you know, just because a receiver drops the football doesn't mean it was inaccurate. Just because maybe, you know, in certain cases that a cornerback makes a great play on the ball doesn't necessarily mean that it was inaccurate. I don't count deflected passes into the equation or the matrix that I use. If it's deflected at the line of scrimmage, then I just count it as deflected. I don't count it as accurate or inaccurate. And the same thing with defensive pass interference plays. I should probably track how many interference plays were generated, and that would probably also help out in terms of, you know, determining how close to accurate they were. And that's something I'm probably going to add in future years, is counting how many defensive pass interference penalties were called. And so I can track that as a separate category and not factor it into how accurate it was, because after all, there's another level of accuracy that I don't think a lot of people talk about, because when they say it was, you know, right now you're looking at catchable accuracy in a lot of these chartings, but what about pinpoint accuracy? Because to me, catchable accuracy is nice, but it goes back to the oft-told Bill Walsh story telling Mike Holmgren not to praise Jerry Rice for catching a post route that, you know, or praising Joe Montana when Jerry Rice caught a post route where he had to adjust to the ball. And Holmgren said, that's a great throw. And Walsh was like, no, it isn't. You know, this is where the ball needed to be. You need to praise Montana only for the throws that are exactly where they need to be placed. And to me, that's pinpoint accuracy. And then general accuracy is the ball's placed where a receiver has a reasonable expectation to make the catch, but it's not placed in the optimal area. And sometimes pinpoint passes aren't throws that are made in stride. Sometimes they're throws where the receiver has to make an adjustment, but it's because of the where the coverage is that the throw had to be placed in that fashion. For instance, going over the middle and protecting the receiver, you might have to throw it low and in or low and behind the receiver so that he can make a sliding catch and avoid getting punished. That would be a pinpoint throw, even though the receiver had to make an adjustment. So I'm looking at all of these factors. You know, it's a lot of stuff, and I charted every throw that I did for 7 to 10 game, you know, every throw that a quarterback made for a 7 to 10 game sample. And it's not a lot of data. I mean, if you really look at it, when you start categorizing it into these little buckets like this, the data gets really small, because then you're looking at, say, deep sideline throws for a guy like, you know, Drew Lock, you know, and if you watch 10 games of him, you might find that the number of deep sideline throws he made on a, you know, from a drop, set, and throw, that he only threw 5 of them over that span of time. It's not a big sample size. But the secret is that with most data that's being charted, there isn't a big enough sample size to really say it's statistically significant. You're using it as information to help you contextualize accuracy as much as you can. And there's going to be flaws with that. But the bucket-based approach, separating all these different buckets, I've been told was a good way to go about doing this in terms of people I trust who've analyzed quarterbacks for professional teams, you know, with data, and have been paid to do so by, you know, higher-ups in the league. And so looking at this, you know, I found that it was pretty interesting, because how do you drive accuracy with it? You know, how do you kind of score accuracy with all of that statistical data? And that was kind of the next challenge with this. And I asked, you know, Mark Schofield, in addition to, you know, some of the people who I originally talked about with this, who, you know, I just mentioned vaguely. But, you know, one of the things that was said is, why don't you look at some of what NFL Next Gen Stats is doing, because they're doing good work with figuring out, you know, researching, you know, thousands of throws, tens of thousands of throws, and figuring out which types of throws are easier or harder. So I looked at that and created what I called thresholds of accuracy for each of these types of throws that I graded. And so, you know, for instance, looking at the intermediate middle of the field, if you're throwing within, you know, 15 to 28 yards in the middle of the field, what's the expected accuracy percentage for that? And for me, I looking at the Next Gen Stats, I looked at that and decided that 63% for an on-platform throw in the middle of the field for that range, 15 to 28 yards, you should be at least at 63% on those throws. So I used a percentage threshold for each of these and, you know, graded players against those percentages. Now, I didn't do it just straight through that way, because again, sample sizes can be small. Sometimes I looked at other things for context to contextualize their accuracy. And so, you know, oftentimes what this helped me do was kind of separate players between tiers of accuracy. I used it as a baseline to kind of put them in tiers. And then I also used different contextual analysis to decide whether these guys were going to get bumped a tier higher or get a bonus in their scoring within that tier, or they were going to get bumped a tier lower. And so sometimes that meant looking at multiple buckets of plays, maybe both, you know, on platform accuracy as well as opposite hash accuracy on platform or mobile accuracy on platform, and looking at all of those pieces together to kind of help, you know, give me a little bit clearer idea about a score, or looking at my observations and notes about players regarding their accuracy in certain buckets, and whether that gave any more additional context to make the grade in that sense. So I found this really helpful. It was very intensive work, to be honest. It took longer for me to write this chapter than any time that I've ever done it. But, you know, again, it was interesting because it raised some players in my eyes. And without giving away rankings, I'm going to talk about some of these points based on accuracy and other things. But one of the players who really surprised me was Brett Rypien, Boise State quarterback. And it kind of made me smile this morning when I got on Twitter and saw that Ian Rappaport had reported the velocity numbers for the players who threw at the combine. And the top two players were Will Grier and Brett Rypien throwing at 59 miles per hour. Now, we've already been through the whole, you know, what is, you know, is velocity that important? And I think Deshaun Watson, he's a good example of a good quarterback put into a system that uses the quarterback to his strengths and minimizes his weaknesses, and you can get playoff caliber quarterbacking out of it. And when you look at Brett Rypien, I thought he was going to be more like Deshaun Watson in that case. You know, watching his tape, you saw really strong vertical and deep accuracy with throws where he could put air under the ball, and he was supposed to put air under the ball. But now we're seeing also that he had pretty strong velocity. Now, to me, you have to reconcile what that number says and what the tapes shows. And I'd give, you know, within that context, I think you'd contextualize that there are certain throws that you have to make that, you know, maybe the velocity didn't show up as well on tape, but it shows also that the arm strength isn't really an issue when it comes to what Brett Rypien does. And watching his game, I just loved how refined he was with drops, with play action, with the varieties of ways that he could deliver the ball, the way that he manipulated offenses or defenses. I mean, Mark Schofield's been talking about Rypien, and that's one of his favorite guys. And I really didn't watch him much. And when Mark wrote up his Brett Rypien thing, I mean, he wrote up basically Brett Rypien's good at manipulating with his body, turning his shoulders, turning his chest, you know, and I saw that right away. But I also saw, you know, great play fakes from center, from pistol, from shotgun. He could do the zone read. He could give full extension, turn his back to the defense. He could incorporate pump fakes and turns and shoulder fakes and look offs and turns of his body towards a certain side of the field, all within his drop to be able to manipulate a defender. And on top of that, his drops were so quick and precise that when he would end his drop, his feet would stick in the setup spot where they needed to. And with little adjustment, he could be in a throwing position, really no adjustment at all, whether it was a 1, 2, 3, 5, 7 or 9, or, you know, 7-step drop. And when you look at those types of drops and the fact that he can be that precise, that speaks a lot to tempo. Quarterbacks need to play at a brisk tempo. It's very important that they do that because it's the timing with routes. It's their ability to process information fast to keep the defense on their heels. If the defense can see what the quarterback is thinking, the quarterback is probably playing too slow. When a defense reacts to what a quarterback does and can jump a route and anticipate it, again, more times than not, the quarterback's playing too slow. He's slowed down at some phase of his execution. And so one of the things that I love about Brett Rypien's game is that it's just quick, 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 on the beat, in rhythm, high tempo, and it's in control. It's under control. And he's a tough dude. I mean, he's not a big, big guy. He's kind of a taller, skinnier guy. But this guy can get bent in half if it means he's going to get an accurate throw to a receiver downfield. He's very smooth in the pocket. This tempo doesn't change when he has to avoid pressure, and he can use his good footwork to slide or roll or spin or climb or combine those different types of skills in the pocket to maneuver away from pressure and hit receivers downfield. So he really surprised me. I think, to be honest, he could wind up being a starter in this league. I don't know when, and we'll see if he gets the draft capital, you know, this buzz, this bump, which he, I don't think he will. I don't think he has the draft capital to be picked early enough where he's going to be assumed to be a starter in the league. Maybe he'll surprise, it'll surprise me because maybe scouts, I would imagine scouts are, some of them are seeing the same things, and maybe there are higher ups who are intrigued with Rippon enough that they can talk ownership into the pick and ownership can buy into it. And if they do, then I really like what I see from him. Another guy who surprised me on a little bit of a lesser scale was Trace McSorley. McSorley out of Penn State, you know, and he was recently asked to work out at the combine as a defensive back. And then you saw Saquon Barkley come out and say, hey, Trace McSorley is getting disrespected. This is a raw deal. He's a good quarterback. You know, he shouldn't be asked to do that. Well, first of all, listen, you know, I appreciate Saquon Barkley wanting to defend his guy. And, you know, that's great. And certainly I think Trace McSorley is a quarterback prospect. But at the same time, evaluators are just doing their due diligence. You know, it may seem like an insult, but if, you know, I've gone to interviews, you've gone to interviews in your job, and somebody might say, you know, I know your resume says these things and that you're skilled for these areas and you've had experience in this area, but have you ever thought about trying this type of work or doing these types of things? How interested would you be in doing that? That's an interview doing due diligence because they recognize potential talent elsewhere. Now, we look at it when it comes to the NFL as the reason they did that is they don't think Trace McSorley is talented enough to play quarterback. So, and there's probably some truth to that perspective, which is what angered a guy like Barkley. But hey, you just got to prove it, you know, and Trace McSorley is ready to prove it. And when I take a look at his production, and really not really look at his production, but look at his charting. You know, I see a guy who's not far away or as far away from having contributor starter like accuracy in the vertical and deep ranges of the field. And I think that that's something that I found interesting. I mean, looking at his data, he was, you know, for me in the middle of the field, or excuse me, in the short range of the field, you know, he was close to, you know, he was over 85% in accuracy in what I charted and say that the middle and the flats in the short area, sideline area, he was at about 50% when the threshold's at 60. And I'm talking about pinpoint accuracy. If you add in catchable accuracy, his short sideline work and sideline's the hardest area to throw, according to Next Gen Stats, he was at 83% total for catchable throws. If you combine pinpoint and general accuracy, that's really strong. You'd expect that for a good college quarterback. In the intermediate range, look, the middle of the field, the threshold for on-platform throws, which are most of the types of throws you're going to see from these guys, 63% is the threshold for the middle of the field in the intermediate range. If you combine his catchable accuracy, he was at, you know, close to 75%. And then if you look at his intermediate flat numbers, just pinpoint alone, he was well over the threshold at 66%, 67% actually, and the threshold was 60%. And then the sideline, again, difficult throws, 55% is the expected accuracy for intermediate sideline. He was pinpoint at a rate of 63%. So you're looking at short and intermediate game, good enough. He can do it in that area of the field. And then on top of that, the vertical accuracy was intriguing because 58% is the expected accuracy in the middle of the field. And he was at 50%. Now he was a little more boom bust in that area. He was either completely inaccurate or pinpoint accurate, you know, and the sample size was a little small. The flat, the vertical flat, if you combine his catchable accuracy to the flat, expected accuracy was 58%. He was at 83%. Now, only 33% of his throws were actually pinpoint, but 50% of them were catchable. And then the vertical sideline was 50% was the expected accuracy. 40% of his throws were pinpoint and the expected was 50. And there was another 20% of throws that were catchable accuracy. So short, intermediate, vertical, he can get it done. And I think there are certain types of throws that were with him that were better than others. And then you look at, say, the deep area of the field and, you know, the data was quite small here, but still you saw some evidence of deep accuracy in the sideline and the flat. So when you look at him, it's often the narrative, I think, with Trace McSorley is he had Chris Godwin, Deshaun Hamilton, Saquon Barkley, Mike Gesicki, Miles Sanders. You know, he was just surrounded by great talent. And he's a good college player who can run around the field and distribute the ball like a point guard. Well, you know what? Good quarterbacks do distribute the ball like a point guard, but he also could get the ball downfield to his receivers. And from what, you know, the big question to me is whether or not that general accuracy in the vertical and deep game is driven by his arm talent. If he doesn't have the arm talent to really transcend that and become more pinpoint, then that may be what limits his potential as a player. But I think he's going to give it a fighting chance, and I wouldn't be surprised if he turns some heads in training camp as a decent backup somewhere, as a guy who's fighting for a backup role, who winds up on a practice squad and has some growth to his game over the next year or two. So who disappointed me in this particular class? And I think the answer, you know, that stands out the most is Missouri's Drew Locke. And, you know, when I look at Drew Locke, you know, a lot of people talk about him and say, oh, he might be the next Patrick Mahomes because he can throw off platform and he's got a big arm. But his arm's not as big as you think. His platform, off-platform accuracy is not nearly as good as Patrick Mahomes. It's the extent of it might be short-range off-platform accuracy when he's really doing the wild stuff. And it's not even pinpoint in that range. But the thing about Locke, the reason he disappoints me is that I think he knows what he's supposed to do, but I think he's so enamored with his arm that he doesn't work diligently enough to maintain consistent techniques, and that doesn't translate to the field. His game is a light switch when it needs to be a thermostat. You know, you always hear that good leadership's a thermostat, not a light switch. And I think Drew Locke, his game, you watch Florida, you watch Alabama, you'll see him with crisp drops. His footwork's pretty darn good. His tempo's is at the level it should be at. He's climbing the pocket fast. He's able to move and process the field at a pretty good rate. And you're like, wow, he looks pretty good, even if the numbers aren't great. You know, he's looking pretty good on film here. Then you watch other games, other SEC games, other non-conference games, and he's walking back from the snap. His movement's slower. It's just lax. It lags behind what it should be. His throws are late. He's often throwing off platform because of the fact that he's not really playing at a great tempo. He's playing more playground like type of style. And he ends up not being as accurate. He's not reading the field as well as he could. He's not on tempo. He's not on point. And so what I see from that is he turns it on and turns it off. As nice of a guy as he might be, as good of a leader he may project him, that the projection may be about him, I don't know what kind of leader he is. But I know that from on the field, he turns it on and turns it off. And so he needs to, and the reason he does that is he gets away with things because he has a big arm. I mean, you look at his accuracy on platform and it tells you the story, okay? Because the routes that require the most anticipation are in the intermediate game and maybe the low end vertical, the low range of the vertical game. Short area accuracy is fine. You know, middle, he's at 82% pinpoint, 71% for the flat, 75% for the short sideline. That's good data. I mean, that's all over the expected accuracy range threshold. When you look at the vertical or you look at the deep range, 53% is the expected range for the deep middle. He's at nearly 67%. The deep flat, The expected range is 55%. He's at 50% pinpoint and 50% general. So that's nice. Deep sideline, one of the harder throws, 45% of the expected accuracy. He's at 60%. So you know he can sling it deep. He's got good accuracy deep. But then looking at the intermediate and vertical ranges of the field where you really need to anticipate and be crisp and on time because of the distances of the routes, the intensity that they need to be run at, the tempo that you need to have. Well, in the middle of the field, 72%, and that's above the expected accuracy of 63%. In the flats and sidelines, he's at 50% at the sideline when the expected is 55. Now he's good at the general accuracy point. So, you know, 95% of his throws are expected accurate or, you know, are accurate enough, but only 50% are the intermediate sideline. And then the intermediate flat, he's at 38% and the expected accuracy is 60. In the vertical range of the field, you know, the expected accuracy in the middle is 58. He's at 20%. Now, at the sideline, it's 50% is the expected rate. He's at 30% pinpoint. You can see where, and it's not just the data, but when I look at it in context of how I observe these throws being made, you could see that he often went off platform in situations where he should have been able to stay on platform. He wasn't using his feet well. He wasn't in tempo. He made throws that really didn't have to be made the way they were. He created lower percentile throws out of situations where he could have had higher percentile throws. And that's what kind of concerns me about him. I think he could be the best quarterback in this class if he decides to be a thermostat with his game. Now, the question is, though, is it already too late? Should he have been a thermostat earlier in his career? Because if he was that, then maybe his approach to the game would be a lot more polished and refined and ingrained in what he does. Now you have to wonder if whether his game has enough ingrained good things in terms of these details to be able to say that he can just turn it on. I'm not sure he can just turn it on. I think he's going to have really strong moments. But if you ask me, he's much more Jeff George and Jay Cutler than he is Patrick Mahomes. And both those guys had moments of excellence, had Pro Bowl caliber moments, Pro Bowl caliber seasons even. But, you know, Jay Cutler's story was a complicated one, when I may talk about more, and I have talked about it in depth elsewhere. And George was kind of the prototype for all-world arm talent, but really never could put it all together. So that's the guy that I find probably the one who disappointed me when I started doing a lot of this. Now, the most quintessential NFL-type traditional picks this time of year: Daniel Jones and Jarrett Stidham. When I look at those guys, I see players whose games, the components of their games, the parts of their games, there's parts of their games that are really good, that are starter caliber, things that decision makers get excited about. Look at Daniel Jones, and he's got the arm strength. He can throw on the move. He is tall. He's able to throw with people hanging off of him in the pocket. He's someone that has a good variety of drops. He has in terms of his drop back game, he can drop from center. He can work from pistol. He has terrific play fakes. His play fakes, I think, are as good as anybody in this class. He and Brett Rippon and Easton Stick have really strong play fakes. So I look at that, and there's a lot to like there. The accuracy, not quite there. The decision making, not quite there. You know, the ability to maneuver in the pocket, while he can do it technically, it's slow and it's plodding. Sometimes it looks like he's doing kick slides rather than actually hitching. I mean, it's just awkward looking sometimes. And those types of things slow him down. Now, he can correct mistakes he makes with certain types of reads, but his processing is slow. There's lots of miscommunications with his receivers on tape. He had more deflections of passes despite being 6'5 than any quarterback in this class that I charted. He had 11 deflected passes in a 10-game sample. Kyler Murray, in the 10-game sample, he had two. So that whole height thing's kind of overdone when it comes to deflected passes and seeing the field. It's really about how quick you process information. And I don't think Daniel Jones processes information quick enough. Or he can be too quick and predetermined information. It's interesting to me. I think he's quintessentially an NFL pick because he's tall. He weighs the proper amount. He's got the prototypical size. He's got a prototypical arm. And he had a prototypical coach who was known for coaching the Mannings, who's the Mannings' personal coach. Well, let's consider the fact that the Mannings were talented. Nothing to take away from David Cutcliffe. David Cutcliffe, I'm sure, is a fantastic coach. But what we've talked about in the past and in this RSP cast with guests Will Hewlett and Rich Bartell, who are quarterback coaches and former college quarterbacks with some pro experience, is that even they, as nationally renowned quarterback coaches, say the quarterback coach gets a little bit overrated. There's a little too much business to some of that, and that you have to understand that it's often about the player. You can teach the player about things, but whether they learn it or not is a different story. And what we hear about David Cutcliffe and his name's like a brand behind quarterbacks is he's had the Mannings, but he's also had quarterbacks who you never heard of become starters in the NFL who've played for him. So, you know, that's something that, it's not to throw shade on David Cutcliffe. It's just to put it in a realistic context. And I think that the problem is that when it comes to pre-draft buzz, Daniel Jones, people are going to latch onto things that they like, which are the arm, the size, the conservative academic Southern school with good, you know, with a good reputation for academics. And you're going to say, this is the kind of guy that should be a leader and a quarterback. And they're going to think that the things that he doesn't do well can be taught or fixed. And I think the problem is that the things that they think can be fixed are really the underlying things in his game that prevent him from actually being the sum of his parts. Same thing's true with Jared Stidham. I mean, this was a guy who was touted as possibly the top quarterback in this class. You know, early in the year before the game started, then the game started and his game didn't live up to that. Now we're in the audition phase, as we talked about in the last episode, and those physical skills, the arm strength, the ability to do scripted work is really starting to stand out and generate some buzz. And I like his arm strength. I like some of the potential he has for starter caliber accuracy. He's close, but he's not quite there. But, you know, he leaves the pocket too fast. He doesn't always process the field as fast as he should. You know, he's like a good looking suit where there's lots of threads that are kind of hanging off of it. And then if you pull the thread, the arm might come off the suit. The buttons might pop off. If you put it on too quick, you might rip a seam. If you catch it on a doorknob, you might tear a hole in it because it's just not constructed as well as it should be. The fabric's nice. The pattern's nice. The cut looks good. But the actual way it's pieced together, the threads running through it, the craftsmanship of it being together isn't strong enough to hold up. And that's my concern about Jared Stidham's game versus Jared Stidham's auditions. So those are the two guys that I think are quintessential picks who will be picked higher than I have them. And then we'll finish it up. The guy who I think is the steadiest performer, who's been the steadiest, I think, all year. I've liked him the same all year long. I think he's the thermostat, even though some people will look at that and say, that's a little weird because he didn't really have a great postseason in terms of the pre-draft carnival. And that's West Virginia's Will Grier. Will Grier, to me, has some of the best accuracy in this class. I think he is athletic enough to be able to buy time in the pocket for the NFL. You know, his combine numbers weren't great, but they were good enough. I think he's the most creative, intuitive quarterback in this class. You know, you can say, what about Kyler Murray? He's creative. Actually, I don't think Kyler Murray's as creative. I think Kyler Murray's more athletic, and people mistake athletic ability and change of direction skill with creativity. I think Will Greer infuses all the disparate parts of his game into quality production better than Kyler Murray does. I think that Will Greer is a guy who, when you look at the sum of his game, it equals the parts, at least equals the parts of his game. You know, and it was funny to me that this morning I saw Mark Schofield retweeting Ian Rappaport's numbers about who had the two strongest arms in terms of velocity in the way that they were tested at the combine. And the answers were Brett Rypien and Will Greer. And when I watch Will Greer as a deep thrower, you know, I happened to see this morning too that, you know, Kyle Krabs, who's doing good work over the Draft Network. And the Kyle's talking about, for him, he saw the only problem he had is that sometimes he puts the ball up and lets his receivers have to kind of work and get it. But I would probably argue a little bit that some of those throws you expect are actually supposed to be thrown with air under it. You know, and I've seen throws where he's put a lot of times, I mean, a lot of the throws that I charted in his sample, he had a ton of drops where the receiver had no one in the area to really threaten him, where they were throws in stride, running away from the defender with their separation, and they still couldn't catch the ball. There were throws on a line that they couldn't catch the ball. It's funny to me because when I look at the West Virginia receivers, I think some people look at them and say, these are going to be some pretty good players and kind of underrated. And if you ask me, I think they kind of held Will Greer back a little bit in terms of what he did. And Will Greer is one of the most productive college players at his position last year in terms of the stats. And I think that if his receivers were a little better at catching the football with perfect placement, he might have been the most productive quarterback in this class. I think that's the difference. I mean, that's how many drops I saw. So when I look at Greer, his rating really remained steady for me. His grade remained steady for me because the things that were more carnival aspect, I didn't pay attention to with any quarterback. And the things that really mattered to me, he just consistently was steady with it. So it's interesting, you know, who surprised me? Brett Rypien and Trace McSorley. Who disappointed me? Drew Lock. Who I think are the most quintessential NFL type picks, who may not be deserving of the picks they get and are more projections than they are reality, Daniel Jones and Jared Stidham. The guy who I liked the most in terms of how steady they remained in terms of my admiration for their game, Will Greer. So that's this week's look at the quarterback class. You know, certainly there are other guys that we could have talked about. I think Tyree Jackson is intriguing. Gardner Minshew could be a whole conversation. You know, Ryan Finley's a fun look. And then, of course, everyone's talking about Haskins and Murray. You know, there's even Easton Stick who I think might be my favorite player in this class, even though I don't think he's remotely the best. I just like him because he's a scrappy kid and might surprise. But again, those are conversations I may have on other podcasts. So thank you for listening. And I got to get back to work and start this running back class. Maybe next week I'll do kind of the same type of thing with running backs. You can follow me at Matt Waldman on Twitter. On YouTube, Matt Waldman's RSP Film Room. My site, www.mattwaldmanrsp.com. And you can buy the RSP. You know, you can get it pre-order a download login and password. So when it's ready, you'll get emailed. You can download, you can get that at www.mattwaldman.com. And you can, when you get that, know that you're also giving back or allowing me to give back to a cause that I've been doing since the Penn State scandal. And that's To Darkness to Light, an organization devoted to training people on how to prevent sexual abuse of children. And also how to address the issue when it does unfortunately occur, so it doesn't compound issues for the victim. Because one of the most damaging things for victims of sexual abuse when they're kids is when families or communities don't believe them. Very rarely, statistically, I mean, like 1% of cases, if 1%, are false cases. Think about that. So, you know, what happens though is that celebrity or power can often sublimate the needs of the victim. And as a result of that, that causes a lot more damage because kids don't understand why the people closest to them abandon them or don't believe in them. And when you're living with that, that people are telling you you told a lie, that might be one of the most damaging things that has occurred to you, that you can't even barely process alone. That creates a whole world of problems for young people. Now, there are a lot of people who are able to overcome that and move forward in their lives with or without help. I've known some people who've been through this, and they're incredibly strong people. But, you know, I've also seen people who've gone through this, and the way that the families and communities reacted to it, it made their coping much more difficult. And, you know, this is what Darkness to Light does, is to make it easier to be able to be advocates in a positive way and to be able to prevent it. So give back and 10%, you know, buy the RSP, enjoy the product. And I believe you will. I think you'll be pleasantly shocked. And then you also know that you're giving money to get training. And we've been able to, at the RSP, being able to fund hundreds of trainings around the country at civic organizations, schools, you know, police departments, fire departments, PTAs, school, you know, individuals, businesses that interact with children. We've been able to do that thanks to you. So hope you guys have, you know, a terrific week ahead. I'm going to dive back into the cave here and start on running backs, which always a personal favorite of mine. And you guys have, you know, enjoy the podcast. Let me know what you think. Rate and review if you feel like you like to give some feedback. Thanks.